Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm the control operator for this Limark TechNet. 44-odd years. We've all kind of gathered around the radio on a Sunday night at 8 p.m. To learn from each other, to teach each other, and entertain each other. And once again, I thank you all for coming back for this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and then I will return and give you the usual links. We have an email address that you can contact us. That would either be for what we used to call mailbag questions. Those are questions you'd normally ask during the technical net, but because you're not in radio contact, you email it to me, and if it's interesting, we discuss it, and you can hear it either on the audio stream on the Internet or in archive form that is available after the end. Also, if you have a topic that you are interested in, that you're knowledgeable about, that's made the news, and you want to share some of your insight with us, you can contact me and ask. We're more than happy to get people's expertise. Or if you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always searching for TechNet puzzles, so if you got them, share them with me, and if I can kind of twist them into the shape that I like them to be for the TechNet, hopefully we'll have lots of fun. Also, if you want to contact Paul, if you've seen something space and related and you'd like to hear Paul's take on it, of course you can send him email directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But if you want to contact me, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. We also have a link page of interesting articles and YouTubes and all kinds of things that I've cut and pasted onto my list in the past week. It's available 24/7, so you don't have to rush now. You can do it in the middle of the week. Just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the link page. We have a chat room available if you're so inclined. You type into your browser chatc2gs.com to get there. And as I mentioned earlier, we have a Internet audio stream of the technical net and generally of the Glen Oaks repeater for the rest of the week. You just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the audio stream. And I always like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site called amateurradio.tv. It has episodes of this technical net that go as far back as September 2000. Fortunately, more than a few of those people have either moved away or become island keys, but their wisdom is frozen in bits on that site. So check it out. It's very elucidating. Let me drop for a second, and I will tell you what we got planned for tonight. We will, of course, have our regular question, answer, comment, what have you. I'll ask people to hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign, and it's a topic or a question or what have you. I would like the early ones to be amateur radio rated, since it's amateur radio net and a repeater. But, you know, we will be open to any questions of science and technology. Before that, I have a couple of words to say this week about ROTS and artificial intelligence. Last week, it was actually quiet for a change. This week, it was not quiet. So I'll drop for a sec, and I will say my bits and pieces, and you can either reply, respond, or just quietly say no thank you. So let me drop for a sec. Once again, this is AC2GS. Recently, the battle for the artificial intelligence has heated up. Good old Facebook, that goes by the name of Meta these days, has their own large language model. It's called the Llama, and they announced the release of what they call Llama 3, which is a much bigger, hopefully for them, better large language model, generative artificial intelligence. It comes in two sizes. The big hunking monster is 70 gigabytes of data, and the smaller one that can possibly hit on your Raspberry Pi is only 7 gigabytes. What some people are doing, they're installing small huddles of large language models onto things like Raspberry Pis and such, and having their own closed artificial intelligence system that they could talk to, and it doesn't report back to daddy or mommy or what have you. So Llama 3 is the big AI boogeyman for this week. No doubt there'll be a lot of reports of what it can do and what it can't do and how it screws up. And it should be fascinating. Also, kind of a secondary aspect is robots. I'm sure everyone has enjoyed Boston Dynamics, that little dog that they put those on, and that are working with police departments and all kinds of things. It's a dangerous duty. They had something that they called Atlas, and they reported that Atlas was being retired, only to a few days later bring out Atlas 2. The original Atlas was a humanoid robot that Boston Dynamics manufactured, and it was partly hydraulic, so it kind of reminded me of the Tin Man before he got oiled. He was able to do interesting things. Occasionally he fell down, but it was interesting. Atlas 2 is fully electronic. There are no hydraulics. They're all electric motors. And gosh, they released a little demo video. And if you were scared of Terminator, you're going to be frightened of this guy. He can twist his body all over the place. He can turn, from looking in one direction to being the opposite direction. It's a incredible piece of designing. You should out that YouTube video of Atlas 2 just to kind of see what the future of robotics is going to bring to us all. Anyway, those are the two things I'd like to bring up. If anyone wants to respond, they're perfectly free to. Just hit that push to talk.
I'm your related.
Honestly, I think you checked it for the questions and such. I was just trying to see if my comments about artificial intelligence and robotics elicited any response. But I'll put your name down. Did you say amateur radio related?
That is correct.
Okay. Anyway, anyone with any kind of comments on what I said, or shall we just go to asking people if they have any questions? Well, I heard a little noise, but I didn't hear any audio. So if that was a person attempting to get onto the repeater, you might want to tweak your radio, adjust your antenna, increase your power, or do something else. We'll give you a second chance there. No, sorry, it's still 100% noise. I couldn't hear any voice in it, so... if you have another radio, if you have another antenna, or if you would like to try out that link, it's sometimes a bit of a challenge, but otherwise, it's, if that's the only way one can get into the to the repeater, so be it. So we'll give you one last try. Not still noise. Well, I tell you what, like I said before, you can kind of either change position, change radios, change antennas, or try out Echolink. It's a free application. All you have to do is credential yourself with the group that you're a properly licensed amateur radio operator, and you get on W2VL, and we'll be able to hear you. But we'll be taking questions throughout the rest of the night anyway. So if we're not able to kind of hear you right now, maybe a little bit later you can try again, and maybe we'll be luckier that way. So I wish you luck. Okay, so let's open up for general questions. Wesley is top on the list for tonight, but hopefully there are other people as well. So if you have any questions or topics or comments to make, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
John, Lulu Charlie. W2BZ non-ham radio.
Rich and John recognize. Anyone else want to put your name down on the list for tonight? Okay, we will start with the three people, and as is usually the case, as the night progresses, I'm sure other people will pop up with questions and comments and what have you, and we're perfectly open for any of that, you know, until we pass by about 10:15, when the poll will be space network. Anyway, Wes, you have a related question or comment, please. What is it tonight?
Interesting. In December, radio release results about ELF, ELF, ultra high, ultra low frequency. Let's start with WSPR. Thank you. Yeah, that's in the second part of the email, 8.3, WSPR amateur radio software. But it has much larger application, and I would love to.
Okay, Wes, unfortunately someone who isn't our fan was kind of jamming you up for most of what you said. I know what you sent me. Whisper, we kind of discussed Whisper. Whisper is yet another one of those great programs that Joe Taylor has packed in, I think it's WSJT is his kind of Swiss Army knife of low signal strength a computer algorithm software to do all kinds of fascinating. Wesley, maybe you want to fall back in position and give this guy some time to fall asleep, hopefully, once he gets tired of doing this to you, or me, or whoever he's doing it to.
That alone made a lot of application in emergency situations in caves where ham radio operators create a system and created a number of devices that are able to the signals of 1 mile below the ground level. Somebody thinks that radio waves cannot penetrate. It's the email that I have sent to you before that was sent. Okay. That was a number of devices listed that is able to penetrate the earth and the antenna systems for it. I wonder if you had time to review it.
Yeah, I watched it, I saw it, I read it. I don't know if you know that, but about 3/4 of what you said was jammed, unfortunately. So, but like I said, electromagnetic waves travel through all kinds of medium. U.S. Navy, and I'm sure all the other navies, submarines to use very low frequency, and the antenna was in the water, and it got to places. The problem with low, very ultra-low frequencies, the symbol rate is very limited. We talked a couple of weeks ago about WWVB, the standard, that is on 60 kilocycles, and the data, the symbol rate is so slow that it can only really transmit 1 bit per second. Like I said before, Whisper is a very nice piece of software. It operates across the bands, low and high, kind of a reverse beat type of thing, and most of Joe Taylor's stuff is very, very useful.
Okay, it looks like timing doesn't count on the radio because I would hear the carrier can increase the power or done. Now operating at 58 watts. Yeah, I've heard the peak. Okay. Okay. The Whisper is all used in emergency situation. Not only on additional frequencies, which the lower one would be 136 kilohertz, but there is another band that is 474 kilohertz, and I have a few questions about it because it is quite new band for radio amateurs, and I'm not sure if that band is approved. I mean, it was approved in 2008 by FC, but I'm not sure if that band is in use. Back to you.
Okay. I mean, it's in use, but it's primarily experimental. When it was open to hams, it was not. It was a shared frequency with the Navy still, and there's strict limitations on power output and such. And originally, in I think 2008, it was primarily purely an experimental thing. You have to kind of demonstrate that you were doing research, not trying to chat. They opened it up a few years ago in general so that anyone with a license, I think, and as long as they maintain the rules of very limited power output, can operate on those frequencies. It requires someone with a sophisticated understanding of how things work. It's, you can't just go over to a ham radio outlet and buy yourself an ultra-low frequency transceiver. But there are people out there. Matter of fact, amusingly, they're termed loafers. And since my last name is Laufer, I thought that it's kind of a shame that I'm not really into it that much, because I could be, Laufer the loafer type of guy. Anyway, that's my knowledge of ultra-low frequencies. I haven't really played with them. Generally, for the most part, the concept was that you needed either a very long antenna or you dealt with a relatively inefficient outputs. I think that YouTube that you gave me the link to was putting out microvolts at the transmitter end. So you can imagine what the efficiency for devices going that low are. Okay, once again, someone's really stepping on things with an empty carrier, so I heard absolutely positively nothing. Wes, you think maybe we kind of table this for a little bit later? Maybe our friend will wander off and annoy someone else? Wesley, I don't think we're going to be able to do this now because of this other gentleman. So, again, maybe we should table it for the time being and come back to it and see a little bit later. Maybe he's been distracted with something else somewhere else. Wesley, are you out there?
Okay, so it looks like somebody on the carrier, not on the radio.
Kilo
Echo 2, Charlie Victor Bravo, KE2.
FEVV, Flatbush, Brooklyn. Does anybody have a copy on my station, Kilo Echo 2, Charlie Victor Bravo?
K2, Charlie Victor Bravo. We're doing, hopefully, a technical net here tonight.
Okay, copy that. I'm not going to jump in the band. I do hear someone is keying up. I'm not sure what repeater this is. I see on my radio it says Litmar BHF. What's the QTH, please?
This is the Glen Oaks repeater of the Limark Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. I believe it's on the Queens Nassau County border someplace.
Okay, thank you for that. I was having some on 40, so I'm just kind of scanning through here to see what's what and what isn't. Thank you for the comeback. Kilo Echo 2, Charlie Victor Bravo. We're located in Flatbush, Brooklyn. You guys have a good night and enjoy the net.
Okay, thank you very much, 73. Getting back, I don't know, there's someone out there that's not behaving. Usually you can't kind of do that on Echo Link because Echo Link kind of gets cut off. If you talk to anyone who's a regular player on Echo Link, they have a problem keying the repeater because every time anyone else starts to talk on it, they're kind of blocked out of it. Also, I have a window open that shows me what's going on with Echo Link, and I wasn't seeing any activity. So I don't think it was Echo Link. I can't tell you exactly what's going on. It might not be that it's Glen Oaks that's being played with. It might be that it's the other repeater that we're listening to, and effectively that kind of screws everything up.
We're going to put it on later time. The only thing is that I want to know if you can hear me now.
Yes, I heard you right at that point.
Okay. Handle the two gentlemen and then we try to return it. I have quite good information about the antennas and the methods of communication.
Okay, we'll give it a try again. But let's give it a little bit of a rest. And, you know, maybe it'll just kind of wander off or fall asleep. Anyway, I appreciate you being flexible with this, as otherwise we'd just kind of be listening to empty carriers for the rest of the night. John, N2ZZ, do you have a question or comment for tonight?
Yeah, good evening, Roy, and good evening, Ned. Roy, I was just wondering... I remember when I was staying with E.E. that, I think I mentioned this before, I'd read many different books, get many different explanations until one finally sunk in. And I remember in the early days with Ohm's Law, there was a great example of a garden hose where the water would be the current, and if you pinched it, you'd get less volume, but you'd get more force, that'd be the voltage, and it kind of clicked with me. So I am just wondering, in yours or anybody out there's wisdom, if they have any other physical explanation that would trampoline over for the magnetic and the electric field when we're talking about antenna theory.
Okay, I've used the hydraulic energy myself. I've written a bunch of little articles for the newsletters and such, and I've pulled those pictures of those three guys with the pipes and because hydraulics is not the same as electromotive forces, they provide a very nice analogy. The problem with electromagnetic waves is that there's a lot of analogies out there. Some are better than others. Some are terrible. Some are decent. It's sort of you got to kind of fit the one to kind of give you the analogy for the question that you're asking. And a lot of it doesn't translate. Electromagnetic waves are waves. So anything that demonstrates the property of waves can be used as an analogy. But that's just for waves. When you start to describe other aspects of electromagnetic waves, unfortunately, the analogies fall completely apart. Matter of fact, this worried and concerned a lot of physicists in the late 19th century. They spent a great deal of effort trying to figure out the medium that the wave was propagating through, because all other waves have some medium that they're propagating. Sound waves have the air. Water waves has the water. Just about every other wave has a medium. And so they came up with the luminiferous ether. And they spent a lot of time and effort. They built really beautiful pieces of equipment, interferometers that are designed to detect the movement of the ether around us. And unfortunately, electromagnetic waves do not propagate on a medium. Unless you want to call the medium the electromagnetic field. That's in every portion of space-time that's available. But they didn't really want to have that. They wanted to have an actual substance. So sometimes it's good, sometimes it's terrible. And analogies are not designed to give you a complete understanding. They're meant to assist you in kind of getting on with it and trying to figure it out. Are you out there, John?
Okay, no, I'm sorry, Roy. Sometimes when you're talking, I don't know if you're with the repeater, kicks in and out. I thought that might have been it. Okay, let me ask you. You said you wrote up one or two articles on it. Are they anywhere available? Is there anywhere I could search them out?
Well, they'd be available as back issues of the Limark newsletter. That's kind of the only place that I put them. I haven't really posted them on any pages, per se. So I don't even know if Limark gives people access to the old newsletters. You might want to email the president, Rich, KNB, and ask him if there's a way to kind of have access to that. And, you know, a couple of times a year when I was so inclined, I would write articles, newsletter.
Okay, yeah, look, I think he's got enough on his plate. I won't trouble him with that. I'll just do some more search on the web. Many times you deliver very well analogies and explanations, so I figured I'd give it a shot. All right, listen, thanks, Roy, and maybe back again after I find stuff out later with future date and with some questions. So as always, a pleasure. November 2 through Charlie, we're going to be on the side. Back to next.
A2GS. Well, thank you very much, John. Thanks for participating. I do appreciate it. And we'll talk to you down the line. Let's move on to Rich, W2BZ. What's your question for tonight, Rich?
Yeah, it's a scientific question. Has to do with barometric pressure. What it is, how it's measured, and why is it important? Basically, that's it, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, we live on a planet that, thankfully, has an atmosphere. It has an atmosphere because it has enough of a gravitational attraction to gas molecules that they don't just kind of float away, which was kind of the case in a lot of moons. Our moon is basically a vacuum because it's so small that the amount of gravity it exerts on any gas molecules that kind of percolate out of it just kind of waft away. That's also a reason why Mars, which has a lower a gravitational field than Earth, has a lower, a smaller amount of atmosphere. So atmosphere is gas. Gas has weight. Weight has force. You can kind of conceive of it as the weight of gas molecules at the very inner aspect of our atmosphere, kind of pushed down to the Earth because of gravity, and then the gas lower, a little bit lower down, pushed down, and a little bit lower, pushed down, a little bit lower, pushed down, and finally, when you get to the surface of the Earth, you have a force exerted by the atmosphere. That is called barometric pressure. Different things can affect the local barometric pressure. Changes in it portend storms that are coming, because high pressure areas, if you ever hear weathermen talk of high pressure and low pressure areas, they're talking about what the barometric pressure recorded in those areas are. So I hope that suffices, but if you need further information, please tell me.
Well, why does low barometric pressure mean bad weather, for instance?
Well, I'm not a meteorologist, but the assumption is that that's indicative where there's a low pressure area, you're kind of pulling in cloud cover and other things closer to you. That's usually going to increase the risks of storms and precipitation and such.
Okay. And then a related question is, have they pressurized an airplane cabin? How do they regulate how much pressure should be in there, and how do they do it? I never understood it. You know, if you're flying at 30,000 feet, how do they make like you're on the earth?
Okay, well, fundamentally, you engineer the airplane to be sealed, so air should not leak out of an airplane, so that it has a certain amount of air when it's on land. And when you seal up all of the doors and such, most of the air should remain inside the airplane, and so the pressure should be approximately the same. There might be some little loss. When things that shouldn't happen happened, like that door fell out, you have a kind of instantaneous equalization of pressures. Fortunately, when that happened to them, they weren't in high altitude, as far as I recall. So the precipitous pressure drop wasn't as severe as it could have been. If they were higher up when that happened, then there would be probably a lot more problems.
Do you know how, is that out there? You know, do you know how they pressurize an airplane?
Again, you don't have to particularly pressurize an airplane. It comes pressurized in relation to ground level. The idea is what you want to do is you want to keep the air seals working so that there's no leak. As long as there's no leak, though the pressure out on the outside of the airplane is much lower, without a route for the gas to take to go out, you're not going to drop your pressure. So it's a matter of being air sealed. You know, it's sort of the same thing in the space station, except that they bring more oxygen and gas to kind of maintain the pressure. But you need to have a decent seal. You know, when the Russians kind of screwed something up and put a hole in something and developed a leak, they had to replace with tank gas supplies.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, and good evening, Richard, too. The pressure inside the airplane when you're in flight is roughly around 8,000 feet, equivalent to that, so it's, you know, it's a little over 10 pounds per square inch, not 14.7. Where we are, it's 14.7 pounds per square inch. But they make it where it's a little lower in pressure, and you know people don't notice the difference. You feel like you're on Earth, and at the same time, it's a little less pressure inside the plane, pushing against the walls, less strain on the airplane itself. So that's why they do that backwards.
Yeah, I mean they can vent air. I don't think that they pump it back into storage. They probably just vented. But I'm sure they have kind of emergency gas tank in case of disasters and such. But, I mean, ultimately, the thing that ensures the fact that the airplane won't completely depressurize is that it is relatively airtight.
I think they have systems on an airplane to deal with the pressure. Like if the door blew off at 30,000 feet, you would instantly lose pressure, and besides having the oxygen mask come down, well, if the door stays, which it would, stays open, they wouldn't have any way to repressurize the cabin. But as Paul was saying, if the pressure is at 8,000 feet, that's what they pressurize the cabin for, they must have a way of depressurizing the cabin or repressurizing it or constantly monitoring it and adjusting for the altitude, I would say. Anyway, but, you know, I thought maybe if Ed was out there and he knew about pressurization of airplanes, he'd chime in. But just about feeling in the pressure at ground level, then maybe that's what it is. All right, Roy, back to you.
Roy, one more comment. WSUN.
Reporting as ordered.
Okay, Paul recognized, Ed recognized. Paul first, and then you, Ed. I just want to restate what I tried to say. I think what's going on is as the plane is going up to about 8,000, they're opening some sealed vents to lower the pressure to 8,000 feet. And once they get to that point, they lock down the seals and until they drop down again. But, you know, I'm no aeronautics guy. Paul first.
Okay, I heard Ed. I'm sure he'll confirm this. That air that you're breathing in a takeoff will have the same air that you're breathing by the time you land. They change that air many, many times during flight. I don't know, many times, like an hour. You know, it's constantly being changed. So, you know, they just mentioned keep the pressure where they want to keep it. So if you're flying at 30,000 feet, they keep the pressure around, like I said before, the equivalent of 8,000 feet, but roughly about 10, 11 pounds per square inch, not 14.7. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Ed?
I just turned on the radio and heard this discussion, like, you know, a minute. So, let me just say this. I may be missing something. There may be more I have not heard, but yes, airliners and any pressurized airplane have fairly complicated systems where there is air constantly, I mean, engines are driving air pumps that are continuously bringing in outside air, pressurizing it as necessary, you know, exhausting some of it so you maintain a constant change flow. It's not stagnant air. It's not even the same air being blown around from one end of the plane to the other. It's being changed completely from air drawn in from the outside. And yes, as the plane goes up, say, the first 8,000 feet, they probably allow the pressure to hold what the normal ambient is. And about 8,000 feet, about 10 psi or thereabouts, they you know, close it off, and now they begin pumping up the pressure to maintain a constant approximate 10 psi regardless of pressure. And I heard Roy mention something about some backup systems. But basically, a backup system is there are oxygen tanks with the, you know, the infamous mask that if the system cannot maintain pressure, they have to come down. They have to drop altitude to where it can maintain it. And if there's a significant failure, they just drop the oxygen mask and they get down to lower altitude as soon as possible. Roy?
Okay, very good, Ed, as always. So I hope you got your answer, Rich.
There's also another one.
Yeah, sure, Ed.
There has to be a tremendous amount of monitoring and redundancy. It has happened that planes have lost pressurization and has not been noticed, and that always ends really badly.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, Ed, I'm curious. Have you been following the circus going on with Boeing?
For about 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, I think it's kind of not a secret anymore. People are being fired. Other people are being threatened with crime and charges and all kinds of stuff. Apparently, it's a shame when a corporate philosophy does a flip-flop. It hasn't been the first time. A lot of times, mergers usually end in disasters. Unfortunately, that's going to be on Boeing's obit.
I've been thinking about this for decades. You want my simple expression?
Finally.
The objective of any company is to make money for the shareholders. But the problem comes in is over what time frame. And what we're seeing right now is the obsession is to make money for the shareholders over the next quarter. Which means if it's going to happen 6 months or next year, they don't care. And that's where things really go squirrely.
Well, I agree with you, but you know, I think this has kind of been getting progressively worse, but has been around for a long, long time. There's a lot of people looking for the quick buck. You know, if you tell that they have to wait 10 years, they walk away from you because, you know, they want it yesterday.
I'm sorry. A few thoughts. I remember in 2010, most of us, I think, remember the Deepwater Horizon oil rig that exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. That was the same thing. They invested billions of dollars to put what's called a blowout protector on that rig and would not spend money to maintain it until the blowout protector failed and it blew out and it caused incredible damage. I mean, something like a dozen of their employees got killed. It caused one of the largest, you know, environmental disasters in history. And that was because they felt, no, we spent millions on blowout protector, we're not going to spend another penny on them. And so it's a real epidemic. You see it all over the place. You see it all over the place. And it's absolutely destructive to society. And as far as Boeing is concerned, for 100 years, Boeing had an attitude. We're going to do it right. You can let us do it right and work with us, or even for somebody else. And they made incredible amounts of money that way. But then they decided their quarterly returns weren't rising fast enough, and that's when they threw the whole thing out the window.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like all things, it's a bit more complicated. They merged with, what was it, McDonnell Douglas, who had a completely different attitude towards business. They were kind of much more driven by profit, short-term profit, than Boeing was. And I think, yeah, and I certainly don't want to get into politics or economic stuff a bit, but in the olden days, if management in a company made a lot of money, they ended up having to pay a lot of taxes. Nowadays, not so much. So if you could, you know, give each other stock options and then, you know, pinch pennies and squeeze the stock value as high as possible, when you get your stock options, you too can be a multi-millionaire. So, you know, back in the 60s and the 50s, the higher tax brackets were incredibly high. It was not terribly cost-effective to make a lot of money because you just ended up paying it all to Uncle Sam. So you invested in the business and you settled for a decent salary and the prestige of your position as opposed to getting paid bonuses of $50 million when that year you lost money.
There are other aspects, too. I mean, McDonnell Douglas was able to be bought out by Boeing because the short-sighted ineptitude led themselves to near bankruptcy, so they're easy pickings. What Boeing basically did was to buy their facilities, you know, buy what they had. And the plan, I believe, was to get rid of the management that drove them to near bankruptcy while getting a good price on, you know, the plus line, the, you know, the tire structure. But somehow, and I'll never figure this one out, the clouds that drove Donald Lewis into bankruptcy or near bankruptcy bubbled to the top, and they're trying to do the same thing only, and I will never, ever, in life, understand how that happened.
Well, you know, it's a business struggle. Sometimes you get the bear, sometimes the bear gets you. And they were able to show relatively intelligent management people that if they practically burned down the company, their own personal fortune would increase tenfold. You know, don't underestimate greed. It's a fool's vice.
Well, my question is, the Deepwater Horizon fiasco caused BP billions and billions and billions. Boeing's escapades will cost them billions and billions and billions. I guess the question is that where is the money going to come from? And if people can pocket millions and millions and millions, or somebody else like the public pays billions and billions and billions, you're still going to find that happening. And another note, you made a comment about the high tax rates in the 50s. Now, I'm not an economist. I was not an adult then, obviously. But I do have a theory, and I think it's getting short shrift. I think the idea was that there were large exemptions for putting the money back into the company. What they were saying is, if you make a lot of money and you roll it back into expanding the business, if you built a new plant in another state, you're fine. It's when you shove it in your pocket you get killed with taxes. And if that's the case, I think that was not such a bad idea as everybody makes it out to be.
Yeah, well, it depends who you talk to. I mean, all things in moderation. So, you know, have some kind of a compromise. You know, when all of a sudden you wake up one day and say, I'm going to give billionaires trillions of dollars, and it will trickle down. I think anyone who uses the term trickle down should be institutionalized, personally. That's neither here nor there. I think one of the big problems is these companies lost billions of dollars, but no one goes to jail. No, almost no one ever goes to jail for these white-collar things. Unless you screw billionaires. You know, that investment guy, I'm blocking on his name. He passed away a few years ago. He screwed wealthy people. He went to jail. But other than that, they don't go to jail. They might be fined. They might have their reputation tarnished somewhat, but their retirement seems to be rather comfortable.
You think of Bernie Madoff, and I have my own comments about trickle down. Are you ready?
Sure. I mean, it's a fallacy. It's been a fallacy since the Laffer report. The powers that be keep dredging it back up. But I'd love to hear your opinion.
The only time the phrase trickle down comes up should be followed by, I'll give you a referral to a urologist.
Okay, so we're in agreement. I mean, the whole concept back in the 80s was absurd. It was tried, it failed, then it was tried, then it failed, then it was tried, and it failed. You know, it kind of, again, is indicative of the irrational nature of humanity.
November 2, Zulu Charlie?
Yeah.
Yeah, just to back up your comment there that the only time people go to jail is when you screw billionaires off. Well, that, you know, going to jail is government intervention. What always struck me was when all those billionaires lost money in the Madoff Fund, all of a sudden we all found out that there's a government insurance policy for certain mutual funds. So I just wanted to throw that in, that doubly backs up your theory, your statement.
Yeah, it's a shame, but, you know, as the old saying goes, life isn't meant to be fair, seldom is. And I love the concept that one law for everyone, but obviously that's not the case. There's at least two sets of law, and probably 25, but I'm not aware of the other one. But it's a shame. But again, it's humanity. Take them or leave them.
W2BZ, can you hear me, Roy? Echo a little wonky on.
Yeah, you're coming in and you're going out, but I heard most of it.
Okay. I just wanted to correct John. I know about the... Fortunately, I know the intimate details of the Madoff affair, and the government didn't spend a dime. People who did get some money back, and 8,000 out of 11,000 never got anything back. That was all paid out of money they recovered from Madoff's company. So the payers did not pay a dime to any Madoff investor. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, but you know, I mean, it's always interesting to me the guys who do go away for a long time, as opposed to all the guys that just you know, the someone pays them off and they wander away. You know, you have good old Sam Bankman. He's going to be going away for about 30 years. Again, I think because he screwed billionaires. I don't think because he screwed any kind of schmo out of, you know, his $20,000 nest egg. I think he screwed enough billionaires that people decided they had to do something about him.
Roy, can I go off top one sec?
Certainly, Ed.
Yes, I have to do penance for an act of religious heresy. You know, tomorrow's the first Seder. Our daughter and her family could not make the taro, so at the risk of angering the gods, we held the first Seder tonight, and I got a kitchen full of dirty dishes. I can listen to you guys, but I'm not going to make it. So I'll be listening to you, and if you call me, give me a minute or two, come downstairs and get set up with real antenna. WB2AD.
Okay, Ed, I appreciated your participation, especially Rich mentioned you, so I'm glad that you picked up the radio and informed us. And Aziz and Pesach to you. I don't know how, I don't know what would cause me to start Passover one day earlier. I'm not a big fan of this particular holiday. I don't particularly care for matzah. If you don't care for matzah, you're screwed. So, Aziz Pesach to you and your family.
Parliament, the word granddaughter changes the universe.
That's very likely. I do not have the fortune of having one, but I could see where that could change your mind.
Yeah, my point is that.
Okay, very good. Anyone with any further comments? By the way, while we were chattering away, Chris, K2ST, was in the chat room. He wrote a couple of comments, and I might as well read them for the audience. He said, all aircraft leak. It's almost impossible to completely seal a commercial craft. There are air compressors. Comment to keep the pressure at 8,000 feet. Some new aircrafts are being built to maintain 6,000 feet of atmosphere. The compressors are part of the filtration and air and heat systems. And his third comment was, part of the jet lag comes from breathing at 8,000 feet pressure per hour. So that was from Chris K2STP, and we appreciate his participation. I assume he's out of range to get onto the repeater, so he logged onto the chat room.
WB2 Alpha Hotel Kilo with a comment.
Certainly.
All right, WB2HK chat. There's also a possibility in Boeing's case, that the government was pressing them to follow DEA, perhaps, and the people that were working on the planes might not have been up to snuff compared to you know, years ago when they would hire you know, the high quality engineers and mechanics to build these planes, and perhaps the government put some pressure on them and maybe the people who were putting the planes together weren't up to quality standards, and therefore the final speed of the aircraft might not have been as good as it was years ago. Maybe that's a possibility.
AC2GS. Well, I hate to get into politics, and I'll kind of jump in and jump out. I don't think so. Pretty much all of the evidence demonstrates that Boeing had rolled back all of their safety measures, all of their checking. They had bucked the government agencies into allowing them to check selves. They didn't seem to do that much at all. So I don't think it's simply they found people who couldn't screw screws in correctly. It's that the entire organization kind of decided to brush the nonsense that went on there under the carpet and just hum and make believe everything was fine. So I hate for politics to kind of color things when a business decides that profit is the only thing, including putting its customers at risk. I hate to kind of turn left or right and blame someone else.
All right, you made me come back. WB2AZ.
Okay, well, you're always welcome, Ed.
Anywho, building and maintaining aircraft involves constant inspection, constant documentation. Everything has to be signed off by whoever does the work and whoever inspects the work. And what they are finding is it's not that people are signing off stuff that wasn't done right because they were too lazy to look at it. They're just not signing off. They're not inspecting. They're not signing off. So I think that's what we're seeing at Boeing. That is an example I'm somewhat familiar with. I'm sure there are other cases, you know, elsewhere. I'm not saying that I think this whole DEI hasn't caused some problems, but in this particular case, everything is force-checked, double-checked, up and down, and they're finding it's just not getting done. And that's an absolute no-no. I mean, you cannot blow that off. So that's a...
Yeah, the problem is that management should be aware of that. And the concept that I keep on getting is that they're perfectly aware of it and they're perfectly happy with that because that keeps the stock price up. It keeps the profit margins higher. If you have to actually double-check yourself, that's not cost-effective for these fools. So, you know, again, you know, people kind of lock into these things and blaming people. I think this is a problem of greed, not of incompetence.
I have a question.
Sure.
The fact that so many fears are checking the aircraft type before they make a reservation, and I think the rule is don't fly Boeing anymore, that's got to hurt the financial picture.
I agree with you, but the problem is, as you mentioned earlier, everyone is kind of worrying about today, not tomorrow. You know, screw tomorrow, give me a lot of money today. And eventually, tomorrow becomes today, and everyone gets screwed. And people learn lessons, hopefully, and stop doing it as much until they forget their lessons, and they do it all over again. People kind of live in the moment. They unfortunately, very few people plan, you know, have a plan B. I try to have a plan B, plan C, plan D, plan E, and plan F if I could manage it. But a surprising number of people just do stuff, and what happens?
Yeah, and when you're talking about airplanes with several hundred people on them, why not?
Well, more than a few times, massively large companies, like pharmaceutical companies, unfortunately, they do a determination of how much will it cost to clean it up and make it safe, and how much are they going to have to pay off to the victims because they decided not to. And every often they come up with a decision that it's cheaper to just screw people and deal with the consequences. Again, talk about morals and ethics and all kinds of philosophical concepts. It's a buck in the...
I don't see that. The downside is numbers like $100 billion. You know, can you really afford that risk?
Well, a lot of these Mitchman types are not going to be there for, you know, for 10, 20, 30 years. They're going to take their gold parachute and take their money and run. So they...